It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up next, Texas State Senator and Democratic gubernatorial candidate Wendy Davis has been the talk of political commentators this week with the release of her new memoir. She joins us here on Central Time.
First, Milwaukee area mayors and law enforcement officials met yesterday for a gun violence reduction summit, along with leaders from Minneapolis and Chicago, to talk about gun violence in their cities.
It's one of those issues that often divides local leaders, but there seems to be agreement on at least one point: the need to expand criminal background checks to include buyers of guns in private and internet sales.
Mayor John Dickert of Racine joins us now to talk about what happened at yesterday's summit and their call for expanded background checks. Mayor Dickert, welcome to the show.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So it seemed like there was general agreement amongst a lot of mayors in your region that there needs to be some kind of expansion of gun buyer background checks. In a perfect scenario, what would that look like to you?
Well, what we need to do, because mayors are obviously working on the ordinance level legislation for their cities, but we have no control over what happens statewide or at the federal level. So what we're looking at is putting together proposals that we can introduce at the state and federal levels to help when our folks are trying to do their work in the law enforcement community, that the law is actually there to back them up rather than them going and trying to either put a criminal behind bars or detain them for a while and going to a court or a judge and just simply being told that doesn't work and you can't utilize that as a way to keep our public safe. So their issue or their arrest is thrown out. What we're looking for, candidly, and what everybody was in agreement with is the fact that we need to protect our citizens. And there's a very small group of people that create a very large amount of crime, and it's violent crime, and there's usually a very good amount of history behind them. So we need to find ways to make the state regulator, the state legislators and the federal legislators understand that, you know, we're the ones that deal with this. We are the people that deal with the police and sheriff's departments. And we hope that they listen to the logic and the reasoning for the changes.
And so what background checks would be happening in your plan that aren't happening now?
Well, right now we have difficulty with background checks, especially with the sales that they have in the gun shows, where there's very little, if any, background checks. Those private sales and those independent shows, that's the start. You know, what tends to happen then is then people buy and sell guns with each other, but you can, at least you have a system to go back to someone to determine where those guns came from. You know, we necessarily, if we want to be honest with ourselves, we can never take all the guns off the streets that you need because manufacturers just create more, whether they're here or overseas. But to know where the gun is, to know the ballistics, to know the traveling of the gun, what crimes it was used in. We're getting pretty good at that, but it gets harder and harder when you have these guns being sold on either private sales or in gun shows or in the black market where you just have absolutely no idea where things are happening. We just want to get to a couple of those things that we think are low-hanging fruit. One of them would be gun show sales. At least get information from folks there that are only going to help to solve crimes. And I get, candidly, for somebody who tries to deal on a logical level, I don't know how anyone can be against or opposed to that idea.
Can you talk about the problem of gun violence in your city of Racine?
Well, actually, we've been blessed with not only a great group of police officers, men and women, but we've put together a strategy here in Racine that has really got us doing pretty well. We've got a 49-year low in crime, and we've had one homicide in the last 14 months that we solved within 48 hours. So we've been lucky, but here's the issue. We are part of a region, and Chicago and Milwaukee and some of the areas around us are dealing with crimes that are at higher levels. That does not allow us to step back away from that problem because people travel through our city. So we have to all be part of the solution. And one of the big issues that we need to work on in this region is the data sharing of information, ballistic sharing, time and shots fired, things like that, who's been selling guns. Those things all help us as a region to solve crimes because, as we all know, nobody says, well, I'm in Racine, I'm not going to create the crime here, I'm going to go to Mount Pleasant and do it. They just don't think like that. No one thinks jurisdictionally. So what we need to do is to work on data and work together as a region to solve these problems.
Some of the mayors were quoted in this meeting as saying this is a moral issue. Dealing with gun violence is a moral priority for people in that region. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. You know, we have a lot of young men and women being killed. And in my background, the way I grew up, that is a moral issue. And the difficulty that we find as mayors is, you know, we're all about getting things done. We are the executives of our cities, and we have to get things done because we can't pass anything on. So when we look at this issue and we see people sitting on their hands and not doing something or not dealing with the issue up front, yeah, that to me is a moral issue because, okay, it was somebody else's son, somebody else's daughter that died recently. Does that, because you don't know that person, does that make it any different? We cannot have our children being killed and sit back and watch anymore. So, yes, I think this is a moral issue, and I think we have a moral obligation to deal with it as leaders. So we are there's a great deal of frustration that mayors are facing because we're not seeing our state houses and our federal government dealing with tough issues, and we think that this needs to be dealt with.
You know, a lot of times this comes down to an urban-rural issue where in the urban area you might see a gun as an instrument of crime. In a rural area, it's a hunting tool that everybody has and uses responsibly. How do you think mayors in urban areas can reach out and work with, say, state legislators whose votes you would need from rural areas to make any of these changes happen?
Well, first of all, and with no disrespect to you, I think that we cannot make that assumption that people in cities use guns illegally or irresponsibly, and people in counties don't. If you look at the gun violence that has happened around this country, you're not safe in a school, you're not safe in a church, you're not even safe in a theater or a restaurant anymore, but let alone your home or on the street. And if you look at gun violence, it is not necessarily related to urban areas. There's gun violence everywhere. The people that were killed in those mass shootings were in some of the richest suburbs in the country. So I don't think that we can make an assumption that because it's in cities, people are not using guns or using guns respectfully. All the mayors that we talked to that were there were gun owners. I'm a gun owner. I have two guns. I started shooting guns when I was eight years old, and we were taught how to respect them and use them wisely. I think the issue here is, are we going to try to make this and divide people by making this an urban versus rural issue? Or are we going to be honest with ourselves and say that this is an issue of violence, period? We can't leave out the mental illness issue that come along with this problem. I think we have to get away from that because, candidly, to me, that's an excuse not to act. And I don't think that anyone who loses a child is going to say, well, my child was killed because they were in a city. Their children were killed, period. And I think we need to stop the excuses and start dealing with this issue because, like I said before, it's a small number of people creating an immense amount of violent crime.
We'll leave it there for now. Mayor Dickert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate you talking about this.
That was Racine Mayor John Dickert. He joined us to talk about yesterday's gun violence reduction summit in Milwaukee and the call for expanding background checks for private gun sales. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
In June of last year, a Texas senator took to the floor of the state house and began talking about women's access to abortions. For over 11 hours, she read letters from women around the state telling stories about why access to abortions was important to them.
By the end of the filibuster against Texas Senate Bill 5, the bill was still destined to pass. But in the meantime, Texas Senator Wendy Davis had captured the attention of a nation. The state house was filled to capacity with supporters, and speculation spread around the country that she would make a run for governor.
Today, she's less than 2 months away from a November election in which she is billed as the first serious Democratic bid for governor of Texas in two decades. This week, she released a memoir in which she details how she rose from being a single mom in a trailer park to the seemingly overnight sensation of June 2013.
Senator Davis joins us now to talk about her new memoir, Forgetting to Be Afraid. Senator, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, Veronica.
Well, you start your book with the story of a childhood memory of trying to help your grandfather write a letter after he'd had a stroke. And this was something that was a struggle for both of you. And this turns out to be kind of a metaphor for your political career. What does that story mean to you?
This is a story from when I was around 10 years old. And my grandfather, who'd suffered a stroke and had been left unable to speak, he wanted so much to communicate to his friends. And, of course, this was back before the days of the Internet. And he tried to dictate letters to me to write to his friends. It was a tremendous struggle for both of us. And both of us would cry on those occasions. It brought home to me the power of voice, how important it is, what it means to lose it, and also what it means to give voice to other people.
Was that on your mind in the June of 2013 when you stepped onto the national stage with your famous filibuster?
It was in the back of my mind, and certainly it's been a symbolic part of my journey as an elected official, a public servant. Giving voice to people is what representative democracy is all about. And all too often, unfortunately, what we see is that the voices of people aren't really the ones that are reflected and represented in our legislative bodies. The voices of some powerful special interests are. And I've always been committed to making sure that the people who elected me to serve them are forefront in my mind. That day back in June of last summer was yet another of many days where I have stood and fought for the people that I represent. I've tried very much to be a voice for them. And quite literally, I had the opportunity to do that day by reading the letters, thousands of letters that we'd received of people who wanted to share their very personal stories about the issue of reproductive rights and why it mattered so much, and in the hope, of course, that legislators would listen and would make a different decision about that bill.
Now, that turned out to be a career-making moment for you, and it did thrust you into the national spotlight. Did it change your political ambitions, make you want to go further?
I wouldn't say that it changed my ambition. What it changed for me was a desire to try to make it not the exception, to try to make it commonplace that people's voices are reflected. I've been frustrated as a state senator these last 6 years watching a political process that leaves so many people out of the equation. In 2011, I filibustered a $5.5 billion cut to our public schools. I killed the bill, but the governor called us right back to a special session to push it through, and we've seen the terrible consequences across our state. My story, my book, is one that talks a great deal about how I came from a place of poverty and struggle, a ninth-grade educated single mother who raised me and my siblings, becoming a single mother very young myself. I understand very personally the power that education provides. Through my start at community college and ultimately graduating from Harvard Law School. And it is why I fight as strongly as I do to make sure that as many young children have the opportunities that I had.
Well, so far, response to your memoir has been focused largely on the revealing that you have had two abortions yourself for medical reasons, and roughly a third of adult women are estimated to have had at least one abortion in America. What do you think it is about that part of your book that has elicited the most comments from the media and elsewhere?
I think, you know, as one of my colleagues in the Texas Senate is fond of saying, when you put a face on debates, on issues that we're debating, it changes the dialogue. They move from the abstract to something that's much more personal. The day I read stories on the Senate floor, it was very personal to me. And I felt inspired by the folks who had been willing to share their personal journeys, to share my own in the hopes that it would help other people who might be struggling with some of the same very difficult decisions that I had had to confront.
You waited until now to do it in the form of your memoir. Why didn't you share those stories when you were doing the filibuster and reading the stories of so many other women and placing yourself alongside theirs?
The stories that I read were ones that inspired people not only across our state but across the country who were watching that day. I think that storytelling is very powerful. Through it, we can find ourselves. Sometimes we find shared experiences that are helpful to us. When my former husband and I were confronted with the news that our much-loved, much-wanted baby daughter, Tate, was suffering from a severe brain abnormality, it was the stories that our doctor provided us, that other couples had been willing to share, that helped us move through our decision-making process and to handle things in the way that we did, doing what we believed was the most loving thing we could do for her and saying goodbye, but also through other stories, making a decision to hold her, to baptize her, to memorialize her in a private ceremony with close friends and family. Stories are powerful ways to connect to each other as humans, and they provide us strength in times when we need it most.
Now, some analysts are saying that by sharing these stories now and by having so much attention focused on them, that you're essentially becoming the abortion rights candidate and that you could be alienating potential Hispanic voters who tend to be Catholic and are also key to any Democratic victory in Texas. Is that something that you're factoring into your Election Day calculus?
You know, I don't think of this as an election calculus. I think of it as I said a moment ago, there's power in putting a face and humanizing these issues. My memoir is a very powerful representation of what education can do in people's lives. And I hope that that part of it inspires people to see why it is that we as a state must invest as we once did in partnering with our young people who are willing to work hard so that their dreams can come true. I hope that the electorate is really focused on that and so many other issues that are important to us as a state. Primary in this race is the issue of education, our failure to appropriately invest in our children's future, and the desire that people have, whether they are Hispanic or African-American or Anglo or Asian, the desire they have to make sure that their children have a brighter tomorrow than they had.
Your own story is one that is remarkable. You grew up incredibly poor, mostly with a single mother. So much of your book is focused on losing your father again and then coming back around to finding him, but also just the poverty and how much you had to come up through with your brothers and sisters. But that kind of climb is something that cultural critics are saying is becoming more difficult in America. Do you see that as something that's still possible in today's world?
It is more difficult. There's no question that it's more difficult. And it's why I'm willing to put my head down and push through fear and fight this fight that I'm engaged in right now. It should not be the exception. It should be the rule that every child who is willing to work hard can make something of themselves. And there's been such a tremendous disinvestment in making that possible, not only at the state, but at the federal level as well. I was the beneficiary of state grants and federal grants that helped make college possible for me. There is much greater demand for those resources now than there are the resources. And I want to make sure, as the governor of our state, if I have the privilege to assume that office, that we refocus our efforts, not only because it's good for individuals, but because it's good for our economy, to make sure that every person has a part in the 21st century economy of Texas, and that we have the workforce that will be needed to fill the jobs of tomorrow and to keep the Texas economic story strong.
We're speaking with Texas State Senator and Democratic gubernatorial candidate Wendy Davis. She got a lot of national attention when she led an 11-hour filibuster against a restriction on abortions in the Texas State Senate. Her new memoir is just out this week. It's called Forgetting to Be Afraid.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're going to continue our conversation with Senator Davis coming up on Wisconsin Public Radio Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation with Texas State Senator Wendy Davis. She claimed the national political spotlight in June of last year when she led an 11-hour filibuster against abortion regulations in the state of Texas. She's now running for governor of that state on the Democratic ticket. Her new memoir this week, Forgetting to Be Afraid.
Senator Davis, the veracity of your personal stories has repeatedly been questioned by your critics, ranging from how you balanced your work and your family life to whether you had an abortion, whether this was a convenient retelling of your story. And some feminist critics have argued that this kind of treatment is essentially a gender issue, that when women speak up, the credibility of the things they say are questioned more often than when men do. How do you think response to your campaign and your character have been affected by the fact that you're a woman?
You know, I don't view things through that lens. I know that some people do, and I do believe that it creates a scrutiny that's different. But I just put my head down and think of it as noise, background noise. I am working on something that I know really matters, and I'm willing to suffer through the criticisms, the complaints of folks who say terribly inappropriate things, because I believe in what I'm fighting for, and it's worth it to me to move through that noise, to push forward, focused on what I know is important for the people of my state, and to fight for them.
Do you consider yourself a feminist?
Of course. You know, I believe that making sure that women have equal opportunity in our world is incredibly important. I believe in women's health. I have obviously staked out a position on reproductive rights, but I've also staked one out on equal pay. I passed a bill in the Texas legislature last session to have equal pay for equal work, only to see Governor Perry veto it, and for the person I'm running against in this election saying that he will veto it as well. And yes, these are issues that are important to women as women's rights, but it's a human rights issue that should matter to all of us, because those of us who are women or who love women understand that we are equal partners in this world, that we ought to be able to earn sufficiently to help support our families, whether we are head of households, single head of households, or whether we are dual wage earners. This is a family issue. It's an economic issue. And I know that this and many other issues that appear to uniquely impact women impact all of us, and that people, whether they are male or female, care about them.
Texas hasn't had a Democratic or a woman governor since 1994 with Ann Richards. What has been the most challenging part for you of campaigning as a Democrat in a largely and famously red state?
It's just battling against the feeling of disenfranchisement that people have and inspiring them to believe that their voices, added one by one by one to the other voices in this state, can cumulatively come together in a way that will make a difference. Texas is the state with the lowest voter participation in the country. And so much of that has come from two decades of gerrymandering that have created a climate where only primary elections seem to matter. It is why I was so committed to this race, to forcing onto the public awareness, forcing into the public awareness an understanding of what's at stake, and a conversation about what our values are and whether they're being appropriately reflected. I see, as I travel our state, people inspired and excited and enthusiastic in a way that we haven't seen in two decades in gubernatorial politics. And I trust that people have awoken to the power of their own voices, and they are going to exercise them in this election.
So are you feeling optimistic then about turning around that low civic participation rate in Texas in the next election?
I am optimistic about it. I trust and believe in people, and I see and trust the power of people in this state today.
Your opponent, Attorney General Greg Abbott, is reportedly outspending you 3-1. Do you see this year's Supreme Court ruling that loosened campaign donations as being a factor in your election, your race so far?
No, actually not, simply because in the state of Texas, we have never had campaign limits. And as a consequence of that, our races tend to be historically expensive ones. My opponent had a cachet of cash built up in a campaign account that he'd been raising into for many years that he was able to start off with. I'm proud to say that in the course of the race, we've actually raised a bit more than he has. Unfortunately, I didn't start with that same heavy balance, but I am so grateful to the thousands of people, a historic number, over 145,000 individual contributors who have made our race possible and who have been willing to invest in it, from grassroots $3 donations to larger ones, in order to make sure that we see a good outcome in this election.
Now, Democrats have talked about the prospect of turning Texas blue. What do you think needs to be accomplished by Democrats in the state to convince people to vote blue in a national election?
I think that if Texas is able to demonstrate that it is willing to elect someone who reflects their values, whether they are independents, moderate Republicans, or Democrats, if we are able to come together in a way that demonstrates that there will be consequences to a restriction and a deaf ear to those values, it will demonstrate something across the country as well. If Texas elects a statewide Democrat for the first time in two decades, it will put Texas in play once again on the national landscape. And in the 2016 election, it will be a place where the conversation will be held, and we will not be ignored as we typically are in presidential races. I certainly hope for that.
If you are elected as governor, both chambers of the Texas legislature will still likely be Republican. You'd still have that structural gridlock to contend with. Given that, what would you try to accomplish with the gridlock in place?
I come from a city council background, 9 years on the Fort Worth City Council, where we didn't have D's and R's next to our name. And that's how I learned to work as an elected official. And I've tried to bring that same perspective with me, even in the partisan environment of the Texas legislature. I know from my years of experience in the Texas Senate that there are plenty of people, Republican and Democrat alike, who know that we need to do right by our state by investing in education and transportation and water infrastructure. And I trust and feel confident that I'll be able to bring a sufficient number of voices together toward that common purpose.
Now, you said earlier that to you, the gender issues surrounding politics is background noise to you. But with so few women participating or being elected in office in politics at the state level and the national level, do you feel that you do have a responsibility to women to be a role model and to help change the status quo?
I do feel a responsibility as a role model. I especially feel that as part of this campaign. I cannot tell you how many times I am greeted by young women who sob, who cannot even speak. And it's a reflection of this pent-up demand that our young women and not-so-young women have had to see someone speak for them. It's terribly important that we elect people from diverse backgrounds, gender diversity, racial diversity, economic diversity, so that each of us and our experiences are reflected in the conversation that takes place in the Democratic forum. I feel an obligation to that, and I'm proud as a woman to be someone who has an opportunity to be a role model. I hold that very humbly and with honor, and I will continue to do my best to be a role model for women across the state.
If you don't win, what's next?
I'm going to win.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Senator Davis.
Thank you very much, Veronica.
That was Texas State Senator and Democratic gubernatorial candidate Wendy Davis talking about her memoir out this week. It's called Forgetting to Be Afraid.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
It's time for our state news roundup, which happens every Friday at this time. Today, we'll take a look at new projections for Wisconsin structural debt, get an update on the John Doe case heard in appeals court earlier this week, and that other one that was heard today. Noah, happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Really a slow news day
yeah,
today.
Yeah, right. There's this growing tradition of the courts handing us bombshells on Friday afternoons. This was a biggie on voter ID.
Right. As we just heard in the newscast just a few minutes ago, the Federal Appeals Court in Chicago has reinstated Wisconsin's voter identification requirement.
And that was argued so long ago, 5 hours that they heard the oral arguments?
Exactly. The arguments were, I think, started at 9:30 this morning, and already they issued this order reinstating voter ID. We've already heard from the Government Accountability Board, who's in charge of elections in the state. They issued a statement a few minutes ago saying they are going to take every step to fully implement a voter photo ID law for this upcoming election in November.
All right. Well, we're going to get more details on that from Sean Johnson. He's pulling them together as we speak, and he's going to check in with us again after the news at 5:30. Well, you know, we are more familiar with the 7th District Court of Appeals Court in Wisconsin than we have been in a long time. Voter ID, there's that same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. And this week, the John Doe investigation. So oral arguments in that. What was going on there?
Right. So let's go back in time just a few days ago down in Chicago. The Court of Appeals took on the issue of the now suspended John Doe investigation that was looking into the coordination between independent political groups and the Walker campaign during the recall elections. If you might remember, a federal judge in Wisconsin had suspended that investigation because he felt like it violated the free speech rights of those groups, including the Wisconsin Club for Growth, who sued to stop the investigation. The appeals court got involved because the prosecutor, who was sort of at the center of this John Doe investigation, who was conducting the investigation, wanted to continue the investigation.
And there was a noteworthy line of questioning from these appeals court judges.
Right. I mean, the judges said, you know, they were questioning straight away, right out of the gate, basically why they were involved.
What are we doing here?
Exactly. Why is this case in federal court? You know, they strongly suggested that this was an issue that should be decided by the state courts.
So this was originally all pretty much happening in state courts. This challenge from Club for Growth, this free speech challenge they did in federal courts.
Exactly.
That's why it ended up there.
Because they were challenging it on constitutional grounds.
U.S. constitutional grounds, mm-hmm. Right. Based on that line of questioning, it sounds like these appeals court justices may not buy that line of thinking.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is, and of course they haven't issued a ruling or an opinion yet, but just based on their comments during oral arguments, you know, they could kick it back down to state court. And if that happens, any number of things could happen. Firstly, that could undo the federal judge's ruling that stopped the investigation, mm-hmm. Which means it could eventually be back on.
Right. And and that ruling said stop the investigation, give back anything you've seized, destroy the evidence. They haven't done that yet because of the ongoing appeals.
Right.
This could, for the moment, turn the ignition back on and they could get rolling on this.
Right. That's one way. That's one way this thing could go. It could also end up back in the chambers of the state judge who's already effectively stopped the investigation because there was a state judge who did. Of course, that ruling could be revisited and perhaps appealed to the state appeals court and then eventually maybe even to the Supreme Court. So what we may see is this whole issue of whether or not this John Doe investigation should proceed, that will come back down into the state courts and make its way through the system here in Wisconsin.
Okay, so what you're saying is it could be the appeals court could knock it out of the federal court system, John Doe investigation back on track.
Possibly. That's one possibility.
Or they could say, oh, state court, you pick it up, which could go to a judge who, as you said, already stopped it once.
And at that point, it could go either way. Mm-hmm. Long story short, you know, this story is far from over.
And time-wise, now, as we learned today, anything can happen with the timing of these things. Is there speculation on when they could rule on this?
Right. So it is possible, and obviously the appeals court now these days is acting pretty quickly. But a ruling could theoretically come before the election. You know, obviously this is a political hot potato. So whether or not the investigation is allowed to continue, you know, could have some effect in the election in November. Although polls indicate that this John Doe investigation, you know, it hasn't really moved the needle a lot as far as this race is concerned. However, the race is tight, so no candidate wants to take any chances with this investigation.
And now we're working on our line of 7th District Court of Appeals trading cards with pictures and stats, and you can collect and make sure you've got all of your favorite justices. I mean, Wisconsin really has an eye on these people right now.
Absolutely. I mean, this has been a big week, actually a big month, really, the last several weeks, really, for the 7th Court of Appeals. A lot of hot topics here in Wisconsin being decided in Chicago right now.
And those trading cards can be yours for a pledge of $10. That's not for a couple months.
Not yet.
Okay, well, let's get out of the courts for a minute. Big news in Wisconsin tonight. We're always budget watchers here. What is the latest news on our budget and the deficit therein?
Right. Of course, this is election time, so all things budget related is going to catch some attention. The Nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau released some budget numbers this week that indicated the state had a structural deficit of somewhere around $1.8 billion. And just for a little perspective, because I think that's important, that would be the third largest gap in the past two decades.
Okay, so deficit 101, what do we mean when we say structural deficit?
I knew you were going to ask me that. Okay, I'm going to really simplify it because it's actually pretty complicated, and I'm not an accountant. But basically, a structural deficit is the amount of red ink that will exist in the next two-year budget, assuming revenues don't go up or don't go down.
So it's the gap between my right arm, which is projected spending, and my left arm, which is projected revenue.
Exactly. Okay. That's exactly right.
Okay. So is the deficit, which way is the deficit moving? Is it getting bigger or smaller?
Well, yeah, the deficit is going up. It's getting bigger. The last time these numbers were released, that deficit was pegged at around $640 million. And the growth in this deficit is largely due to the fact that, you know, revenue is just not as high as people expected.
Okay, now this is all projections in a way. What does it mean for the way government's going to operate going forward?
Right. So there's really a two-part answer to that. From the government operations perspective, it means the legislature and the governor, you know, assuming revenue doesn't go up, you know, may have to cut spending to make up for the shortfall. That said, revenue could go up, and so maybe nothing will have to be done. Of course, the second part of all this, because it's election season, is the political implications of the structural deficit.
So this is one of those things that both sides in the governor's race are going to be looking at. What are we expecting them to make of these deficit numbers?
So Democrats, including Mary Burke, the Democratic opponent in November, says that these numbers are basically proof that the governor is, you know, fiscally irresponsible.
Mm-hmm. And then the governor's response, what's the case he'll make?
Yeah, so the governor has said, you know, he thinks revenue will go up, and therefore this issue of the structural deficit will be eliminated over time. And he also accuses the Democrats of having what he called, this is a direct quote, selective amnesia, because these structural deficits were common or at least occurred during the Doyle administration. The governor points to the fact that when he took over the state, there was a structural deficit of something around $3.5 billion.
And it seems like every two or maybe 4 years, we're talking about structural deficits in this state. This is not a newly invented thing.
Right, because at the end of the day, the, you know, budgets are created with projections. You know, nobody knows, nobody has a crystal ball, nobody guesses, nobody can say for sure how much money is going to be brought in over the course of, say, 4 years.
It'll depend on the national economy.
It depends on the national economy. You know, it depends on state, you know, tax revenue. So there are a lot of factors that go into it. And at the end of the day, they're guessing.
Another story that has a little political implication to it, a lawsuit against the Madison School District, the school board.
Right. So the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which is a conservative law firm on behalf of a resident in Madison, is suing the Madison Public School District as well as the teachers union for not allowing Act 10, which is the law that banned collective bargaining for most state workers.
So they're not, the school district is not following the provisions of Act 10. So what's the group saying? What are they doing? What's the district doing wrong, according to according to the group.
Yeah, they're basically saying the district and the union negotiated a contract that is prohibited under Act 10, and they want the contract blocked. The contract was actually reached between when a state judge threw out the law and when the Supreme Court upheld it earlier this year, hence the lawsuit.
So wait, so the district, as I understand it, and the teachers union have said when we negotiated this, it was legal because Act 10 was blocked at that moment.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly right.
And as I mentioned, election season, there is a political angle here.
Absolutely. The resident who is officially suing the district is a conservative activist. And according to the Journal Sentinel, the CEO and president of a major funder of the institute, which is suing the district, is a gentleman who actually chairs Governor Walker's campaign. So there are political connections there.
And the education issue, I think we talked about this last week, right. there have been back and forth statements from both camps.
Right.
Education.
This education issue has been really hot in the campaign the last 2 weeks. It comes at a time when Governor Walker has attacked Mary Burke and the school board, of which she is a member, for not embracing Act 10. He says the cost savings, you know, could have potentially been used to shrink the achievement gap, which exists in the district and we've talked about before.
And briefly, a quick roundup. The president made a big speech on ISIS, the Islamic State movement in Iraq and Syria. You kind of surveyed from our reporters. What is our delegation saying?
So the Wisconsin delegation, by and large, generally supports the president's decision to use expanded airstrikes against ISIS. Senator Tammy Baldwin likes the idea of an American-led coalition, but says it's important that the president not use combat troops, which he says there are no plans to. Senator Ron Johnson says Obama shouldn't rule anything out. He says airstrikes alone will not defeat ISIS.
All right. Well, we'll be watching that issue definitely in the weeks to come. Noah, thanks, as always, for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
That's our news guy, Noah Ovshinsky. He's WPR's assistant news director. He joins us each week at this time to round up some of the big stories in Wisconsin news.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.